Caterpillar's surprise announcement Tuesday that it's moving its headquarters to Chicago is still sending shockwaves through Peoria, says Mayor Jim Artis.
With the whole headquarters moving, it's still very sobering and very shocking.
Today, we check in with the head of Peoria's downtown development president, Michael Freilinger. A few years ago, Decatur went through some similar changes when ADM and Tate & Lyle moved some of their operations to the Chicagoland area. How are they faring several years later? Plus, Chicago leads other major cities when it comes to youth joblessness. UIC professor Teresa Cordova joins us to share what she's learned from her research on this and in talking to Chicago teens.
They tell us that there is a connection between the joblessness and the violence. And we'll say things like, if my friend had had a job, he would be alive today.
And it's Super Bowl Sunday coming up this weekend. Companies are now paying for ads to advertise their ads. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Caterpillar's abrupt announcement Tuesday morning that it would be relocating its headquarters to Chicago caught the company's hometown of Peoria by surprise. Today, as people continue to react to the announcement, we thought we'd turn to another central Illinois town, Decatur. That's because over the past couple of years, two of Decatur's largest companies, ADM and Tate & Lyle, have also relocated some of their top people to the Chicagoland area. What does it mean for a city's economic development to lose a major world headquarters? And what does it mean for the civic life of the city? For residents of Decatur and Peoria who want to weigh in, give us a call at 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet as well to 21stshow. That's our handle, 21st show, and join our conversation. In a few minutes, we're going to be speaking with the head of the Decatur Arts Council and the Economic Development Corporation of Decatur in Macon County. But let's start with Michael Freilinger, who's the president of Peoria Downtown Development. They're a nonprofit focused on economic development of downtown Peoria. Michael, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
You're welcome.
Michael, you know, we've all been hearing, especially the past couple of days, about how Caterpillar leaders were very public last year about their plans to stay downtown. This morning, I saw the company has said they're still planning some of those renovations of those buildings. Before we get into those details, Michael, what was your first thought when you heard the news on Tuesday morning?
Well, I was with a group of civic leaders. We were brought in and told by Caterpillar of their plans. Obviously, it was a disappointment and somewhat of a surprise to all of us. We did think that we had secured the new world headquarters, which had been put on hold. But given the environment, especially in the mining industry that affects Caterpillar, I think we should understand the decision that they're making. We want Caterpillar to be successful. The good news out of the whole thing is, even though they'll be moving about eventually 300 staff positions to their new headquarters in Chicago, the bulk of their employment base will still remain in central Illinois, in Peoria's downtown and the surrounding area. So they've got about 12,000 employees in the region, and 300 or so will be moving to Chicago. So we're very glad that they're going to keep a significant presence in Peoria. They'll still be paying property taxes to the local government agencies on the buildings that they own, and they're still going to be involved in the community. Caterpillar did commit that they were going to continue to support the community through their philanthropic endeavors, and we're glad to hear that as well.
What are they saying now about its investment in Peoria's downtown?
I didn't hear that.
What are they saying about their investment in the downtown of the city?
Well, we're glad that they have their facilities there, and they just built the Caterpillar Visitor Center, which will remain open and serving Caterpillar's customers, their employees, and the community. So they've made a significant investment over the past few years. They've helped out with a number of projects to improve the downtown. They support the DDC, as a matter of fact, as well as other organizations that work on economic development. So we're pleased with that.
Mm-hmm. Is it even, I wonder, Michael, I guess it's sort of impossible to talk about economic growth in downtown Peoria without Caterpillar?
Well, they're still here and they still have a significant presence there. And we've been working over the past 3 years on various organizations, Peoria Area Economic Development Council, the DDC, the Chamber of Commerce, and the CVB. We've been all working together to diversify our economy, to work on making our downtown a more attractive and competitive place. Those efforts have been going on for the past 3 to 4 years. We've seen a lot of progress, and we believe that we'll be able to continue to improve the region and our downtown so that we can continue to be competitive and attract new companies, grow companies here, and strengthen the attractiveness of our downtown. Many cities have found out that companies are looking for a strong, vibrant downtown, one that has a lot of residential housing where people can live and work within a relatively close proximity to one another, where they don't have to rely on an automobile to commute. And we've been working diligently on trying to redevelop our warehouse district, which is adjacent to the central business district. As a matter of fact, we've had 7 projects, mixed use, loft redevelopment projects in the area. A number of those are complete, and we've got about another 5 that are wrapping up. And they've added over 150 new residential units to the downtown.
Michael, can I ask about Caterpillar? You mentioned that it's one of your organization for Peoria Downtown Development, one of its founding members. I know that several people hold seats on your board. The company contributes about $70,000 a year to your organization's budget. The budget, that's about a $350,000 budget. And I wanted to ask about, there's not a lot of people moving, but what it means when the people who make the biggest salaries are moving to Chicago, about the loss of civic capital. What role do Caterpillar executives play in civic groups like your board?
Well, Caterpillar is very active, and we believe that that the remaining employees that are here are going to be active in the community. Obviously, the position of CEO, not actually living in Peoria anymore, will have some impact. But what we've been told is, given their long history in Peoria, 92 years, and the number of employees that they have, much of their contributions are through matching gift contributions, as well as the Caterpillar Foundation. I have not heard that the foundation is going to be moving up to Chicago, so we'll still have access there. So I'm hoping that and expecting that they're still going to be involved and still supporting the important work of all the nonprofits in the area. But obviously, we need to be prepared in case some of that support begins to diminish, and we'll concentrate on diversifying our contribution base. All the nonprofits will, and I'm sure they'll be mindful of the commitment and try to get reassurance from Caterpillar that there's a period of time that they can expect ongoing support as they have in the past.
That's Michael Freilinger. He's the Peoria Downtown Development President. Michael, thanks for being with us.
You bet.
You know, we thought we'd see how this has worked in other cities, and we thought we'd turn to Decatur because ADM and Tate and Lyle moved some of their biggest people out of Decatur a couple of years ago. And so what we're doing now is to speak to Jerry Johnson. He's executive director of the Decatur Arts Council. It's a local nonprofit that has its own gallery and event space downtown. It also helps support local art groups. Nicole Bateman is on the line from Decatur as well. She's the community marketing manager of Decatur's Economic Development Corporation. Nicole, Jerry, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having us.
Thanks.
Hey, Jerry.
Yeah. Nicole, since 2010, we've seen Tate and Lyle and ADM move lots of their top people, headquarter operations from Decatur to the Chicagoland area. Nicole, what was the impact on the city immediately after this move?
You know, anytime you get news like that, like Peoria is experiencing right now, it feels like a punch to the gut. Everybody kind of scrambles because when you have your top employer saying they're going to, you know, take people out, you take it personally and you kind of think, well, what's wrong with us? What's wrong with our community? And I think we quickly realize that, you know what, there's nothing wrong with our community. And that we didn't take it personally. It is just sometimes the nature of the beast and where they want to head as an organization, and maybe some of the positions don't necessarily fit with the structure that's currently in place in the community, as was the case with ADM and Tate and Lyle. But really what ultimately happened was, yes, they moved, ADM, you know, moved around 50 to 75 jobs. Tate and Lyle had also moved jobs up there. But in the meantime, though, they really secured their commitment to the community by, especially ADM, by developing the Decatur engagement team that was led by the North American president to ensure their connection to the community. So while they were moving some positions out, they said, you know what, we are still very committed to the community. We will not waver in our support because they still, in essence, have the largest base of their employees here in Decatur, with ADM. And then with Tate and Lyle, that move of some of the corporate positions allowed them to really kind of refocus their staff here in the research and development departments.
And so did you all find, Nicole, did you find that in the past couple of years that commitment has maintained?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, and I feel like it's almost stronger than ever. They've been fantastic philanthropic partners throughout the community, you know, not only with nonprofits like Jerry's, like with the Arts Councils, but with the schools and also all sorts of endeavors, the Children's Museum. And so I don't feel like it's wavered at all. If anything, you know, when you're asking David about, or I'm sorry, not David, but Michael about, you know, those top positions leaving and their seats on boards and things like that, you may lose a few members, but it gives other people in those organizations a chance to step up and become involved in the community when maybe they haven't before.
Did you,
and I think that's what we've experienced.
Sure. And did you also find that you turned to other companies as well? Was this sort of, for you all, mm-hmm. from an economic development standpoint, a way to say, hey, we really need to also be diversifying the companies that are here?
Absolutely. You kind of rely on those solid core of, you know, maybe your handful of largest employers to take care of things, right? But when one starts to, you know, restructure or move or think about things differently, you as an organization need to diversify as well. But we have a lot of really wonderful mid-tier businesses here in the community that took that as an opportunity to step up to the plate and say, hey, we're here. We've been here for a long time. How can we help? And that really made a difference as well.
Jerry, for you, for the Decatur Arts Council, did you find that you're with boards and finding people for your boards? What kind of impact did it have on you with, for example, Tate and Lyle moving lots of its top people?
Well, there certainly was a shift in the people who were available to serve on our board. But everyone has been saying, that you kind of adjust to the new normal. There are plenty of people with these companies who are interested in serving on our boards. And so that's what we have done. We found people who are eager to be a part of what we offer the community.
Do you think that sometimes, Jerry, I don't know if we've heard companies say they move, they say they don't intend to forget where they came from. Has it been your experience? Have you found that, has communication been harder with, say, ADM moving its foundation or having someone who's in Chicago as opposed to in Decatur?
We certainly spend a little more time maintaining those relationships, and that's what I would encourage any of the folks in Peoria to do if they find that that's the situation, is to just stay connected as much as you can with those people who have some influence on those businesses supporting your organization, but also engage the folks that are still there. And there are plenty of them here at ADM and Tate and Lyle, and even Caterpillar here in Decatur, who are very engaged in our community in a lot of different ways. So, and all those ways help us in beyond just financial support.
Mm-hmm. One last question for both of you, Jerry. Let's start with you. What advice would you offer to your counterparts, and Jerry, for you, arts organizations in Peoria right now? You said maintaining relationships. What else?
Yeah, I think that's a big one, but also it was mentioned earlier, diversifying your contribution base is very important. I'm sure most people already try to do that, but continue to focus on that, as well as build relationships with the other organizations in your community so that you can support one another. Any agencies or organizations sharing resources, sharing information, and contacts is always very valuable.
Is it something you all had to do as well, or something you've learned to do maybe a little bit better in the past couple of years, Jerry?
I would say a little bit better. Yep, we've always been a very collaborative community here in Decatur, and the community itself is very generous. So diversifying that contribution base is something that just kind of comes naturally here.
So that's sort of the civic side. Nicole, what about from an economic development standpoint?
Sure. You know, I would just recommend that they take a look at the jobs being left behind, understand the skills of those individuals, and, you know, really take the opportunity to work to relocate them in workplaces within the community so that they don't lose the population. Those jobs are moving to Chicago doesn't necessarily mean that the people and those skill sets need to move to Chicago if you can find work for them within the community that will keep them there. Alternatively, there's the opportunity, I think, for Peoria to market the available skills that they have and the workforce that they have to attract new businesses to town.
And I guess I wonder, Nicole, you started this by saying it is sort of like, as you said, kind of a punch to the stomach. How long did it take you guys in Decatur to kind of get over that?
Oh, I mean, I don't know if you can really put it into, you know, I mean, I would say maybe months. You know, there's always the initial shock, but then there's always some confusion on how many people are actually going to move, who is going to move, who's going to stay. When you throw numbers on things, it sounds very scary, and sometimes you don't know how that's actually going to feel in the end. But, I mean,
You sort of have to let the dust settle, it sounds like, right?
Yeah, I just got to let the dust settle, and you move on pretty quickly as a community, especially when you continue to be resilient over and over again like Decatur's had to be. And I think we overcame it pretty quickly.
Thanks so much to Nicole Bateman with Economic Development of Decatur, Jerry Johnson with the Decatur Arts Council. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. One thing we've heard from politicians at all levels in the past few weeks, whether it's Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel or Illinois Governor Bruce Rauner, is that one of the best ways to prevent and stop violence is with job programs. Well, a new report out by the Great Cities Institute at UIC looks at just that link and finds some discouraging news about what Chicago's youth unemployment rate actually is. Teresa Cordova is director of the Great Cities Institute at the University of Illinois in Chicago. She's also a professor of urban planning and policy and one of the authors of the report and with us now. Teresa, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning. Thank you.
You know, we've all seen the headlines and we've all been talking about soaring violence in Chicago, the highest rate of shootings the city's seen in the past 20 years. And so I think the big question that lots of people always wonder about, and you all actually studied from an academic perspective, is what's the link that you found in this particular report between unemployment, the jobless rate, and violence?
Well, what we found is that in those neighborhoods where there's the highest rates of violence, you will also find very high rates of joblessness. And in many cases, high rates not only of those 20 to 24-year-olds who are out of work, but also out of school. And so we call those disconnected youth.
And you make an interesting distinction that I think we should talk about at the beginning here between joblessness and unemployment. What's the difference?
Well, the unemployment rate is an official Bureau of Labor statistic. And in order to be calculated in that rate, you have to also be actively looking for work. And so what our figure does is it captures those who may not be actively working. We do employment to population ratios. So we take that age group and we take everybody in that age group, and then we take of those who are employed and we create a ratio. And then the opposite of that then, or subtracting that from 100, is then your jobless rate. So it's that percentage of that population that is not working.
And how high are these rates in some of these neighborhoods? I know in particular, there are five neighborhoods that accounted for a third of all of the homicides in Chicago last year. What were the jobless rates in those five neighborhoods?
In some of those neighborhoods, for example, it depends if you're looking at 16 to 19-year-olds or if you're looking at 20 to 24-year-olds. But let's just take for a minute the 16 to 19-year-olds. In Austin, for example, it's 91%.
Did you say 91%?
91% for 16 to 19-year-olds in Austin. In Englewood, it's 89%. New City, 79%. West Englewood, 88%. In the greater Grand Crossing, 92%, right? So, and then the 2024 years old, it's given that you have a higher expectation, the 2024-year-olds are working, those numbers are also very high, where you're looking at Austin, almost 60%, Englewood, 67, New City, 49, almost half, West Englewood, 70, and then the Greater Grand Crossing, 66. So yes, those are pretty high numbers for people who are jobless.
So 60% for 20 to 24-year-olds. It looks like at least a lot of those around 50, 60%. When you talk to young people from these neighborhoods, what are they saying to you?
Well, one of the things they say is they want to work. They've been very clear that they want to work. They tell us that there is a connection between the joblessness and the violence. And we'll say things like, if my friend had had a job, he would be alive today. Or they'll tell us, if you're busy working, you don't have time for violence. And that part of keeping them off the streets, for example, is giving them a job. One teen told us, or one young person told us, if you want to save lives, you want to see a difference, give these teen jobs. And they also talk about the difference that a job makes to them in terms of not only being able to have the income, but also to be able to get the various skills that one gets when one is employed. And in many cases, a lot of these young folks are providing income to a household. In most cases, they're helping to support the household, where there's multi-generations living in that household. There are young children. They have younger siblings, for example, that they help support. And in many cases, they have children of their own. So the motivation for the income is to help households as well.
And Chicago, when we look at particularly at specific demographics, actually leads the nation in youth unemployment. Can you explain the breakdown of how that looks like when we look along racial and ethnic lines?
Well, it leads the nation when you look at, we looked at Illinois, we looked at the United States as a whole, and then we compared it to Chicago, we compared it to Los Angeles and New York. So looking at those other large, quote-unquote global cities, Yes, we tend to be higher, but especially for young black men. So that if you look at young black men 2024, their rates of joblessness are higher than any other group in Chicago, and then they're higher than blacks in any other geography.
So they're higher than their peer groups, right, in New York City or L.A.?
Yes.
When you look at the Latino rate, how does that stack up compared to other cities?
Well, one of the things that surprised us when we were looking at the long-term trends here, because we went back to 1960 to see what the long-term trends had been related to joblessness. And what we found is that the recession actually had a really big impact on all groups, and that there is no group in Chicago and that returned to pre-recession level, although there's some recovery. But for Latinos, the downward trend after the recession has continued. We haven't seen any recovery for Latinos after the recession. So that was disturbing. And we also saw that for 16 to 19-year-olds, for example, of Latinos, we also saw that their rates are high for joblessness.
I think as we're thinking about this, we were just talking about sort of the breakdown among different racial groups. I want to ask about Chicago and the transition that the economy made from manufacturing jobs. You know, you were talking about the recession, but I also want to go back a little further and think about jobs that used to exist for a lot of middle class people within the city. How has that had an impact, that sort of systemic economic shift away from manufacturing jobs? How has that had an impact on these young people that we're talking about here?
Well, I think that's one of the major points of the report. Particularly, that's part of why we wanted to look at the long-term trend. And we wanted, if last year we said, for example, the joblessness is related to what's going on in the neighborhoods. So we wanted to look a little closer at what is going on in the neighborhoods. And so we tracked jobs, and we looked at manufacturing jobs as they existed in 1960 and throughout the city, and then as they existed in 2015. And what we found, even though there are slightly different data sets, what we found is not only did it have manufacturing jobs left these neighborhoods and continue to leave these neighborhoods, but so has the retail. And when you look at the private sector generally, you can really see the emptying out of these neighborhoods of jobs. So part of our point is that that yes, that the economic restructuring, that the deindustrialization, you know, the decline of manufacturing, definitely has had an impact on these rates of joblessness over a long time, and that because of that, we're really looking at it exactly what you said, a systemic issue. It is a systemic issue, then part of the solution or the strategies to address this have to be multifaceted, and they have to address some of the structural issues. So we need jobs back in those neighborhoods, for example. And we also need a lot of work to make people, to provide the opportunity for people to be job ready. We know there are jobs in the emerging economy. We know that baby boomers are going to be retiring and that more jobs will be opening up. So how do we match those jobs that are available and becoming available with the people who want the jobs and are looking for the jobs? So that involves, again, also some multi-pronged strategies in providing on-the-job training and providing ways to connect people so they to make them ready, right, for the jobs. The other thing that's happened in these neighborhoods is that the commercial sectors, the retail sectors of a lot of the neighborhoods have also been on decline. So what can we do also to bring back not only anchor employment into some of these neighborhoods, but also to rebuild the retail sector? So one of our strategies that we recommend are small business incubators, because through a small business incubator, you can help provide not only the support work to help people turn their talents and skills into marketable goods and services, but even help with their business plans, along with their marketing plans, and even with some startup capital. So small business incubators, helping to establish worker cooperatives, these are some of the things also that can not only help the young people in the neighborhoods, but can help then also make available goods and services in those neighborhoods, whereas in many cases, they're just not available.
I want to just turn to solutions here and ask you about what you would like to see. And certainly we've seen Mayor Emanuel, Governor Rauner in his State of the State address last week, Mayor Emanuel even yesterday talking about this. What, first of all, what kind of response do you think is needed? Let's go through those. Let's start at the city level. What kind of response do you think is needed at the city level to address these underlying causes of unemployment?
Well, and of course, we're very glad to hear Mayor Emanuel talking more about jobs and making more of a direct connection between the jobs and the violence. And there are definitely some programs that have existed and been cut, are being reinstated, and some new ones. So stepping up that, we think, is really important. But for example, summer jobs programs have been cut at the federal level. They've been cut at the state level. We know that summer jobs is a gateway for being able to provide the opportunity for people to be job ready, if you will. So increasing summer employment, of course, but they also, young people also need access to year round employment. So we know, for example, that during the Depression of the 30s, there were a number of New Deal strategies, a number of other employment subsidy programs, for example, where you're actually paying people to build your infrastructure, for example. There was a lot of programs where you're putting people back to work, and then what you end up with also is increased infrastructure, increased, there's a lot of parks, a lot of things that we ended up with through some of those New Deal strategies. So we think that's important, but we also think it's really important to help keep anchor institutions and neighborhoods. Because part of when you start losing jobs, you start losing your commercial sector, anchor institutions start leaving your neighborhood. It's an overall condition, right, that is that leads to almost a disintegration of the neighborhood fabric, if you will, right? So part of what we need to do is rebuild the neighborhoods, but rebuild them in a way that people from those neighborhoods benefit. If all we do is rebuild those neighborhoods for them to be gentrified and people pushed out further, well, then that's not really helping address the problem. It's just moving it someplace else. So how do we build these in a way that people can benefit is really important.
And I wonder, when you talk about anchor institutions, when we think about the school closings across Chicago, would you consider that part of the, when we, would you consider schools and school closings in that equation?
Well, schools can be a marvelous benefit. Schools, neighborhood schools are very typically a wonderful benefit for neighbors. And there's a movement in other parts of the country, for example, the community schools movement, where there's a real connection between using schools as a center for other kinds of community activities, right? Whether it's continuing education for adults, whether it's community activities. So, yes, schools are a very important anchor institution in a neighborhood, most definitely.
And you mentioned that federal funding for things like the summer jobs program have been cut. I'm just thinking about, in particular, President Trump's discussions about infrastructure and how much he wants to invest in infrastructure, how much he said that he needs to create jobs. How much do you think, I mean, do you see any of this fitting together with federal strategies at all? Is it your hope that perhaps instead of the tweets about sending in the feds, which is, of course, the fight that Mayor Emanuel has been having with President Trump over the past week or two, would you like to see maybe more infrastructure and jobs conversations around that?
Well, we know that there's a lot of infrastructure that needs to be updated. So there is a need not only in the city and the state, nationwide, for more infrastructure development. What becomes important when we do infrastructure development is that public infrastructure remains with the public. So as we rebuild the public infrastructure, and even to the extent to which we have private contracts to help build that, what becomes important is that we not lose our public infrastructure, because that's part of the long-term investments, right, that makes the city healthy, that makes the community healthy. So, yes, there are possibilities there of putting and that's very much what the New Deal was about. You know, you built up your public infrastructure system. There are dams and roads and public libraries and a lot of other public amenities that were built in a way that put people back to work and then left people even decades later, right, that have access to the infrastructure that was built. This is also a really very critical time to invest in public education. This is not the time to be cutting public education, because so many of the jobs in the emerging economy are jobs that require problem-solving skills, critical thinking skills. And so the extent to which we're providing educational opportunities that help build, right, those kinds of skills, right, you're really preparing people for the emerging economy. So we need not only the public education, but along with that, the various skills training. So the more we can invest, right, this is not the time to retrench the economy. This is time to actually invest in it. And we know, you know, there are a number of economists, Nobel Prize winning economists, who will tell us that, in fact, if we invest in these kinds of projects, that it puts more money into circulation, which in turn will spur the growth of the economy, which in turn creates then more job opportunity, which puts more money into the economy, and the cycle continues.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation. We're speaking with Teresa Cordova. She's director of the Great Cities Institute at the University of Illinois at Chicago. We're talking about unemployment, joblessness, and the link to violence, particularly in Chicago, something Mayor Emanuel was talking about yet again yesterday. So stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. We'll pick up this conversation in just a minute.
We'll be right back.
I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening to The 21st. Chicago leads the nation in youth unemployment, at least when it comes to white and black young people in our city, compared to major other cities like New York and L.A. That's a finding from a report out from the Great Cities Institute at UIC. One of the authors of the report is with us, Teresa Cordova. She's also director of the Great Cities Institute. This isn't that much different than what you all found last year, is it?
No, what we found is that, for example, comparing it to 2014, we saw a slight improvement in the out of school, out of work, but we did not. But we saw it actually get a little bit worse for overall jobless rate. So that, for example, in 2014, the jobless rate for 24-year-old blacks was about 59%, and it went up to 8.7 or so, and it went up to 60.2. So it went up slightly.
I guess my point is you all have been doing these reports for quite a few years now, and I wonder what you really want people to do with this data as you all have said repeatedly, the work that you guys have done at the Great Cities Institute at UIC, how bleak these joblessness rates are.
I really appreciate that question. Part of it is, first of all, making connections to the conditions of joblessness to other social conditions. And so that when we go to attack something like or to deal with the issue of violence, for example, it becomes really important that we understand the connection between that and joblessness. So I think it's important there's almost a degree of indifference that developed around this joblessness. And part of what we're saying is, no, it really is even worse than we might have thought, and it really is something that is in the interest of all of us to deal with. This is an all hands on deck approach, I think, because it's a structural issue, and we can't just say it's a function of individual attributes, that it's something that everybody can have a hand in contributing to. So state legislators can help with various kinds of incentives for development in some of these neighborhoods. Cities, of course, can help with that. Federal direct funding for various kinds of employment programs. But we think that we don't want to be indifferent to the condition of joblessness, and because it's really clear the young people want to work, and they really appreciate the opportunity to be able to have access, and many of them will tell us that they prefer that over seeking other kinds of economic solutions to their economic needs, to their financial needs.
Teresa Cordova is director of the Great Cities Institute at the University of Illinois at Chicago. She also is a professor of urban planning and policy and one of the authors of this report. We'll tweet that out if you follow 21ST Show, if you have interest in reading the whole thing. Teresa, thanks for being with me. Thanks for taking the time.
My pleasure.
Some news if you missed it yesterday on Illinois' credit rating. Already the worst in the country, was downgraded yet again by Fitch, one of the ratings agencies. It's the sixth time a ratings agency has downgraded the state's credit rating since Governor Rauner took office in January of 2015. That triple B rating is two notches above junk. What does that mean for us taxpayers? Democratic State Treasurer Michael Furyk spelled it out in a statement yesterday. Borrowing costs money, he said. Borrowing without a budget costs even more money. Frerix added, we know a budget will bring down our borrowing costs, and yet we still have a leadership team that chooses not to negotiate. We can do better. Super Bowl Sunday is this weekend and marks the biggest event in sports. Last year, about 112 million people tuned into the game, and the year before that, a record number of 114 million watched. Those numbers have caught the eyes of advertisers over the years, making the Super Bowl not just the biggest event in sports, but the biggest television event of the year. So much so that advertisers are taking out ads to advertise, well, their Super Bowl ads. To tell us more is EJ Schultz. He's on the line with us from Chicago. He's the Bureau Chief for Advertising Age. EJ, thanks for joining us on the 21st.
Great to be here.
So we see more than 100 million people tuning into the Super Bowl in recent years. Is there a better audience for advertisers out there, or is the Super Bowl still really it?
This is still really it, in my view. There's really nothing else that comes close.
And so how much are companies paying for ads this year?
Right now, the estimates are around $5 million for 30 seconds of airtime. That, of course, does not include, you know, what it costs to produce the ads. And as you mentioned, they're spending a lot of money to promote the ads ahead of time. So the total investment is quite large.
Mm-hmm. And so when you're thinking about that investment, what percentage of ad budgets, is this sort of the big, like when we think about companies and ad budgets, how much goes to just the Super Bowl versus other things?
Well, obviously, it depends on the size of the brand. You know, a brand like Pepsi is going to spend many millions throughout the course of the year. But there are some brands that have smaller budgets, and they make the tactical decision to spend a huge percent of that on a Super Bowl ad in some years. And they feel that it's really, if they're going to make a big statement, it's worth it to do it all at once and to get that exposure that they cannot get throughout the rest of the year.
Right. And I think I'm thinking of some brands that's paid off for, right? Like I'm thinking of GoDaddy. I feel like they did. They kind of made a big splash. Are there brands that it doesn't work for? Like, do we have a sense of what percentage of time it works, or is there data on that?
I think it works for anyone who can do it well. And a really good Super Bowl ad can go a long way. But then the flip side of that is a really bad one can actually cause damage, and you can actually you can put your brand in some harm. So it's sort of a risky proposition, but by the same token, you don't want to play it safe, because why spend a bunch of money on a boring ad, right? That's not even going to get noticed.
Right. And that's the thing. Do you feel like the ante keeps getting upped every year for kind of more and more weird or outrageous ads? Like, I feel like Doritos just tries to get weirder every year with their, I mean, I guess it's their demographic, right? They're going for young guys who think it's funny.
Right. Although, speaking of Doritos, they are not actually going to be in this year's game.
Okay.
Yeah, they ended their Crash the Super Bowl contest last year, and they just decided not to advertise at all in this year's game. And that contest was actually, you know, they fielded ads from anyone who wanted to submit them, so it was not, they were not done by traditional ad agencies. But yes, you're right. I mean, I think, you know, we've become pretty desensitized as a society
right.
to the weird. So you got to keep upping the ante to really stand out, especially what's going on in real life these days. I mean, it doesn't get much weirder than that.
Well, and when we think about that, EJ, I wonder what are the kind of themes, there tend to sort of be common themes that go along with the current time period. What have you seen so far this year?
I feel like everyone is trying to read in some kind of political view into these ads. But the ones I've seen so far, to be honest, have been pretty lighthearted. The majority of them are still trying to kind of get a laugh. I mean, there are some serious ones, and there are a couple that people are trying to suggest that it's a reflection of the political climate. You know, Budweiser is getting some attention for an advertisement that they released a couple of days ago that tells basically the story of the brand, which is created by a immigrant from Germany who came over here. And a lot of people are trying to read into that some larger comment on, you know, the political situation. You know, Anheuser-Busch has said that's not the case. We're not trying to make a political statement. But knowing that basically everything is political today, I mean, you're going to have people that view it in that lens.
Yeah, and EJ, actually, let me stop you for a second, because we actually have a clip of that. So let's, as you kind of set it up really nicely, so let's hear just a little bit of it, and then we can keep talking about it.
You don't look like you're from around here.
Welcome to America.
You don't want it here. Go back home.
Abandon ship! Welcome to St. Louis, son.
And so that's part of it. EJ, you were starting to talk about it. A commercial goes on to show how, as you're saying, this German immigrant went on to become the founder of one of the biggest beer companies in the U.S. And let me ask, I imagine the time frame for this ad must have been created, what, 3 months ago, 6 months ago, certainly before the events of the past couple of weeks.
Absolutely. I mean, it's been in the works for quite some time. You know, obviously it was probably, the concept had many months ago. You know, they're always fine-tuning the production and the final edits and things like that. But the basic idea has been in the works for a while. What Budweiser says is they're, you know, just trying to tap into the American dream, essentially, which is, there's obviously this country has a history of people coming from other countries and starting businesses and thriving and overcoming obstacles. And that's essentially what the ad is saying.
Right. And it's interesting that, I mean, certainly that's the story of the American dream 6 months ago. I don't think anyone would have thought that would have been a political conversation, but it's certainly become one in the past couple of weeks with President Trump's executive orders on immigration. I feel like it's made that notion a political one. And I guess for Budweiser, they've just sort of made the calculation of, look, this is something we don't think this is political. This is part of America's story. And so we're going to go with the ad. Is that kind of what you're thinking, EJ?
That's right. And from the people that I talked to close to the campaign, I mean, obviously all these brands monitor the kind of reaction they're getting. I'm getting the feeling they're still feeling pretty good about it, that, yeah, there might be some negative comments, but on the whole, they're still feeling pretty good about it.
Well, and in a case like this with a company like Budweiser, certainly they know their customers, they know their brand, they know what kind of brand loyalty they have, right? So I assume that companies like this are kind of making a very calculated decision whether or not they're going to air something.
That's right. And I think that we've seen a trend in recent years, and especially in the alcohol category, of brands really trying to kind of tell their heritage story. And so I think that really is what they're trying to do here. But I think that anytime you drop something into the world these days, it's going to be looked at as some people, you know, want to look at it no matter what.
Mm-hmm. So do people still watch the Super Bowl just to see the ads? I know there's a significant portion, not significant, but there's a portion of the population that just does that. Or does everybody just kind of expect they're going to be on social media? You could just watch them on YouTube later. How's that working?
I still feel it's appointment television. I think, you know, it's the one TV event of the year. I mean, maybe the Oscars, too, that people gather with their friends and family to watch TV. I mean, that doesn't really happen a lot anymore. It's not like the old days, right, when we'd all sit around and watch our favorite sitcoms together or our favorite dramas together.
Mm-hmm.
Because those are all obviously you can find on demand. But with sporting events, you know, the fact that they're live, it still drives pretty huge ratings. So I think that there are still big chunk of people that do watch it just for the cultural aspect, and that cultural aspect does include advertising.
So there was an ad about banned substances that was rejected by the NFL. What happened with that ad?
Yeah, I think you're referring to GNC. They said that Fox rejected the advertisement because the retailer apparently has some products that the NFL itself has banned. So they were told they couldn't run their ad.
Okay. Well, regardless, is there anything in particular we should be looking out for this weekend, EJ, in terms of what might be the most fun or favorite ad?
Yeah, there was one that dropped this morning by Honda that I thought was really well done and interesting and charming and funny. It's there's 9 celebrities in it. And what they did is they went back and collected the old high school yearbook photos of these celebrities, people like Tina Fey, Steve Carell, Jimmy Kimmel, and they made it appear as if their old yearbook photo was coming to life. So they're sort of picture their yearbook photo talking, right? And I think that one's going to get a lot of attention. It's just because it's visually pretty cool, and it was really well done.
And there's a rumor, it's not an ad, but is the Star Wars trailer rumored to be dropped during the Super Bowl?
I cannot confirm that. I haven't watched that one that closely.
All right. Well, we'll see. We'll say thanks for joining us. EJ Schultz is a Chicago Bureau Chief of Advertising Age on the ads coming up this weekend for Super Bowl Sunday. Thanks, EJ.
Thank you.
out of time for today. Tomorrow on the program, we're going to be talking about a new book called Specters of Revolt. It's by a Springfield professor at University of Illinois, Springfield. We're going to be talking about revolution. It doesn't always look like 1968, the Arab Spring uprisings, or uprisings in Baltimore and Ferguson. So tune in for that conversation tomorrow. You can always find more information at our website, www.21stshow.org. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.